Okay, thanks for doing this. Can you tell me your name and can you spell it, please?
Paul Noble, P-A-U-L-N-O-B-L-E.
And your date of birth?
The 8th of the 12th, 1963.
And can you tell me where you lived in Leytonstone?
121 Fillybrook Road.
And when did you move to the area?
I think 1989, but I can't really remember.
All right. And what were you? Where were you before that?
I think I'd been squatting in a prefab in Limehouse on Camdenhurst Street.
Right. And that was, you were working on your own work at that time as well?
You mean I was
an artist? Yeah, yes. Doing your own things. And
yes. Right. Yeah, I had a studio in Pixie Street, which was in Limehouse.
Okay, and do you remember who your landlord was, when you were in Leytonstone?
Oh, Acme.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And can you remember how much rent you were paying at that time?
It wasn't much. It was like, it was either £12 or something, but it seemed a lot. It was the first time I'd paid rent for ever in London, so it was, yes, but it was very cheap.
And that was £12 a month or £12
a week?
A week.
Yeah. But it was a very big, really big house, front and back garden. I was sharing it with Sally Barker. I was living with Sally Barker, who was my partner at the time. And there was another artist there called John Pettinuzzo, who had a studio there. There was another artist there called Doug Muir, who had a studio there as well. So it was a big house.
Mm.
Sally and me both had studios in Pixie Street, so we used to travel.
Oh, right. I didn't know that.
Mm.
And you found that easy enough? That was sort of worked out for you to
what?
To rent from Acme? Because how were the other two? Did they have their studios in the house?
Well, it was their place, and I was just stuck for somewhere to live, and they kind of made space. I think, I can't really remember. And so it was, I don't know, I think generally as an artist, you think first about your studio. And so that was, you know, where you lived sort of wasn't quite so important. And I like cycling, and it's quite a nice route.
And how did you find out about Acme? And did you know them anyway? What do you remember?
Well, if you're an artist in London at that time, Acme and Space were very kind of predominant organisations. I suppose it was a little bit like getting a council flat. They were the good things to get, an Acme house, you know, with a studio.
Mm.
It didn't matter that they weren't in particularly good places. They were all in Bermondsey or, you know, Leytonstone, which, you know, socially were kind of like a bit crap because no one would ever come and visit you. But I used to laugh about friends who live in Leytonstone because it was such a crap place to live. No, it was cool. I mean, once you're there, it's actually you realise how nice it was, what a nice sort of community they offered.
Mm.
But that's not necessarily to do with, I mean, Acme were the facilitators and it was the people that lived in the places that made it nice. Acme, I think, were not quite a strict organisation. They probably knew that most artists weren't necessarily the richest of people, so they were quite sort of tough about, you know, paying rent and stuff.
Right.
And, you know, they weren't like, I didn't find them particularly like a friendly body.
Yeah.
But then they probably had to be kind of slightly sort of strict just to ensure that the organisation could survive rather than being a charitable organisation.
Yeah. And do you remember that, how you sort of found that house, that sort of point where Acme told you there's a house available?
They didn't? No, I got through my friends who lived there already, John and Doug.
Right.
Yeah, I was never offered a,
okay.
Me and Sally were never offered an Acme house.
And so were you subletting from them, or?
Not really. I mean, it was just like it was. There was a bit of space for us to be, so we just split the rent, you know, between us.
Yeah.
So I doubt that we were ever on the books, yeah, on the Acme books. Yeah, so I mean, I never had really any professional relationship with Acme.
Yeah. Okay. And in terms of the housing and the area, I think you've sort of touched on it. What attracted you to the area?
Nothing attracted me to the area. It was necessity.
Right. Okay.
I mean, but nothing attracted me to, you know, like where I lived in before. It wasn't like, you know, it was, if you think about London, you don't necessarily think about Deptford, or you don't think about Charlton, or you don't think about, you know, Silvertown or whatever. But I mean, they can actually be quite good places to live once you discover the benefits. And so before, I lived off Salmon Lane in a prefab, and it turned out to be one of the nicest times I've ever had in terms of a place to live. It was a really nice community. There's lots of bikers, crazy bikers, living in the prefabs. There was a few Acme prefabs. I'd squatted in the council estate next door to it before, and I knew people from that, you know. So, you know, me and Sally had squatted. She'd got a house, she'd got somewhere else, but could only live on her own. So like Leytonstone, it was, you know, I knew a lot of people up there. There's a lot of artists. It was just a vast amount of artists, basically. So it's like hard not to know people that lived in, you know.
Yep. And what was the area like at that time? Can you remember?
Not particularly, very suburban, well, as it is now, I guess, very suburban. A strange place with two kind of predominant pubs, the Heathcote and the Northcote. It was just, not, sleepy, I'd say it was. Yes, it's not an obviously energetic place.
Right.
Architecturally, the scale felt kind of small, quiet, secluded, and in a lot of ways, it was probably quite a nice place to be an artist, just to sort of get your head down and get on with some work.
Mm.
But I know that there was a general feeling of neglect by a lot of the artists that worked there, and they felt that no one ever took any notice of what they were doing. At that time, sort of about 1989, for a lot of artists, there weren't really many outlets to show your work. Commercial galleries at that time generally didn't show people who were younger than 40. The showroom was run by Acme or Space, I can't remember actually, which was a space you could rent out. There was like a very few small spaces that you could get to show your work in, but there weren't any. There was a few artist room spaces, but not really. I think there was a lot of artists making stuff, but apart from open studios, it was kind of an odd, very odd situation.
So when you say neglected, you mean neglected by the art world in that sense?
Well, there wasn't even an art world. I think, now there's the sense of there's like vast amounts of people that have employment around cultural production, but they don't actually do anything themselves. They just, either buy and sell, or curate, or organise, or write about, artists and art objects. It's like it's massive, but then there wasn't, I mean, there wasn't, that didn't exist at all. There was commercial galleries, there were just very few, and there was very little outside of that. I think maybe 10 years prior to that, there'd been a lot in Butler's Wharf, and you know, there'd been a lot of artist initiatives, but somehow they'd all sort of died out, and I don't know quite what happened between the 70s and the 80s, but somehow I'm not sure. It's quite interesting actually that to work out why all the kind of, you know, where Stuart Brisley and people like that were coming from, where that, you know, where their energy went to. That's a whole different point to be explored, actually.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, definitely. And in terms of your house, or the one that you were renting, what was that like? I'm just thinking, you know, what did it look like? What was it like physically?
It was grand. It was. It had clematis growing all up the back of it. Really big garden. Beautiful. Whoever had it before had, you know, put really beautiful plants in. There's camellia, roses. The back garden backed onto the Leytonstone Central Line train station. There was a little bit of land, like I'm not sure who it belonged to. But there was like a strip of land between the platform and our back garden, and that area was full of fruit trees,
right,
and brambles, so it was there was a lot of sort of foraging to be done, you know, so a lot of fruit picking and, you know, jam making, all that kind of stuff. It was nice. It was very close to Epping Forest. You'd often have cows wandering off of the forest that, you know, people were using the common rights to the land for their animal stock. It's quite bizarre. So, you know, some mornings you wake up and there'd be like loads of cow shit in the street. Next door but one, there was a really huge post office, sorting office, really beautiful Victorian red brick building. The architecture was nice, but as a street, a little bit like the whole area, there was an invisible wall running down the middle of Grove Green Road and Philibrook Road, because one side was blighted by the announced plans in the 50s or whenever for the extension of the M11.
Mm.
And the other side was going to be left alone. So the CPOs had happened ages ago. And then, I mean, so one side of the road was all sort of like, you know, in inverted commas, proper families, or, you know, living in proper houses. And the rest on the other side of the road, the, not just artists, but the, you know, predominantly artist side, it was all things, you know, the houses weren't so well looked after, you know, in terms of upkeep. They might have been decorated in, you know, nice, interesting ways, but they weren't necessarily, you know, the pointing wasn't kept up to scratch, and the, you know, the doors, the front door wasn't repainted every 5 years or something.
And only went into the house, could you describe sort of the structure inside and...
Not really clearly, no. It was big, you know, like you went up the front path. In the front garden, there was orange lilies. You could see down to the basement. There was a basement that Doug used for sort of smaller sculptural stuff. You went up some stairs, there was a big door with a protected sort of front entrance.
Sort of arch over the top.
That kind of thing. Really big hallway, wooden floors, big wooden stairs. You could go straight through to the back room, which was really big and had big kind of French windows. Gorgeous house. Mm. Quite high rooms. It was like, you know, great. Mm. Really good.
And you were upstairs or downstairs?
I can't actually remember. I can't remember. I think John had the upstairs front room as a studio. I don't really remember. I was there for blooming ages. I think there was a lot of flux because Doug lived there with his partner Tina, who was also an artist, and he was really involved from the beginning in the M11 campaign. But he really took it. He was. He still works at Net or whatever they call Nelt now. And I think he works there as a technician still. But he took it quite personally, and he was one of the first casualties in a way, and he had a breakdown quite early on.
Right.
And he lived there. I think he moved out. Well, he was hospitalised, and then he moved out. Or just to convalesce. And then John moved out as well. I mean, basically, it was me and Sal were left there on our own after. Mm-hmm. There came a point when ACME sort of basically asked the people to start giving up their houses.
Mm-hmm.
I think in a way ACME had no choice because of the way that they were structured, that they relied on being given blighted property.
Mm.
Their goal was quite particular.
Yeah.
And it was obviously wasn't about fighting kind of political battles.
Yeah.
About whatever, you know. So they were kind of basically saying to most people that if you want to be rehoused by ACME, we want you to honour the agreement you signed and move out.
Right. Okay.
As and when, and it was. I guess it was because I'd never relied on ACME, neither had Sal. It was easy for us to take the notice of that.
Mm.
We were only nominally, we were paying rent to ACME, but we'd never actually signed any agreements with them.
Mm.
I doubt that would have made much difference anyway, but it was, you know, it was difficult for a lot of artists because they did work in their homes, and I suppose for them to basically once you'd sort of gone past the contractual point where you know ACME said that you are no longer under the ACME umbrella, whatever, however you want to put it. There's probably no way of knowing how long you'd have before you were evicted.
Right.
So for a lot of artists who had their studios there, it probably was quite worrying because, you know, it's the thing that as an artist you hold most dear, all the things you've made.
Mm.
And you don't want them to suddenly be chucked on the street because that's what you imagine to happen.
Mm.
Yeah, you know, by the arrival of bailiffs or whatever. So John, who lived in the house, he said, you know, what's more important to me is being an artist than getting involved in this particular struggle. So, you know, he just sort of never stopped, you know, supporting the campaign, but he was always an artist first. And a lot of people were like that, I think.
Right. And you talk about Doug had a nervous breakdown, and that was just a personal thing, or was it, do you think that was partly that situation you're describing, which is you're living and
I flipped him out, yeah. No, it wasn't to do with his work. It was, I think it came to a head during the part of the campaign where there was a public inquiry at Stratford Town Hall. And George Saxon and his boyfriend John, whose name I can never remember, second name, who'd been part of the Grey Eye group for quite a long time. Do you know the Grey Eye? It's a disabled theatre group.
Okay.
And I can't remember what John's disability was apart from being drunk a lot, but he had a visual impairment.
Yeah.
But anyway, so they brought a lot of, and George is like a very good filmmaker. I don't know if you've been in contact with him.
Not yet.
George Saxon
will be. Yeah.
He's quite a lively character. Anyway, they're quite a wild pair. And so they lived together on Grove Green Road, and they basically brought a lot of their theatrical imagination to help disrupt the public inquiry into the M11. And the main kind of sticking point there was that at that point, public inquiries into schemes like the M11 Link Road took no account of the environmental consequences of this kind of development. They were seen purely in terms of what financial benefits they could bring to an area. So we knew that it was highly unlikely that we were going to get the result we wanted. So the best thing to do was to try and just prolong, disrupt, and cause. Make it as an expensive, you know, nuisance as possible. And Doug, I don't know, I think he was like a strong man that realised that he wasn't strong enough to stop. I think he felt that it was all a bit too much for him. You know, perhaps he was someone who couldn't see collective strength and thought that it was down to, you know, him as an individual. There's a lot of stuff, you know, that it was about, really. Maybe it could have happened over anything. But it was during all the kind of the managed madness of the inquiry that Doug kind of did pretty full on lose it. So it was like, it was pretty horrible because you know, we were having meetings all the time about what to do, and you know, and often in the meetings, a lot of the stuff sounded pretty mad anyway. But Doug was mad, and so it was like it added quite an odd. It was quite surreal, really. Interestingly, there was a lot of, at the point of the, before the public inquiry and during the public inquiry, there was a lot of people from outside the area that got involved. And sometimes it was hard to know if they were there to support the campaign or were there to help pull it apart through making trying to influence the direction of the campaign in sort of destructive ways. So I only mention that in terms of it was quite an insane kind of, it was hard to know which was the right, you know, if you're in an avalanche and you're covered in snow. I mean, the thing often is you don't know which way is up and which way is down. So it was like that quite often.
Right. And those are meetings which were sort of part of a more formal campaign.
No. It wasn't. The campaign perhaps became formalised after the public inquiry, when I'd say that the campaign became formalised. Afterwards, when Richard Layton sort of took up the ropes, perhaps, but before there was so many different kind of people feeding into it. There was Patrick Field from Hackney, who was part of the cycling kind of cycling campaign. There was Reg from Hackney Downs, who was brilliant, and there was a lot of people from Archway. There was a lot of, some people moved into the area that had had experience of other places. My next door neighbour was Colin Bex, who was an amazing guy. He's still battling away, doing things. But I mean, really, it was like it was like a very loose collection of people that made time to. It wasn't really a formal. On Wednesdays at 7, we'll have a meeting to discuss the next thing. Something had happened, and whoever was around would make themselves available and get involved. And you know, it's like, or if you couldn't be there, you'd make sure that someone on your, you know, you'd sort of try and make sure that there are enough people there to do something. Mm. And for whatever reasons, it was important, you know, probably for personal reasons, certain people became important. Like my friend John, who decided to not be involved. Mm. For him, he was probably having important decisions to make about his work that were kind of overrode the particular battle with the government over a road building scheme, which is, you know, at the time seemed quite kind of prosaic.
Mm. When you, just to step back 1 second and then maybe we can come back to the road building, were you aware when you moved into the area that the houses were blighted and that the road was going to be built? Or was proposed?
Yeah, of course.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, also, I've been squatting a lot, and you don't, it's not really a question of thinking when you move into an empty property. You don't think, and this is where I'm going to live for the rest of my life. You just think that this is an unused structure, and you can make it a livable place. And you know, it's a waste of four walls, floor, and a ceiling.
Mm.
But you don't think, you know, you just enjoy it while you've got it, and you make it a nice place to live. While you can, and you get to know the people around you.
Yeah.
And it was exactly the same in Leytonstone. I think the reason why a lot of people decided to get involved in fighting against the M11 Link Road was probably as much to do with things like the poll tax riots. Poll tax, just general sort of pissed offness with a very sort of divisive government that were doing, that were forcing through a lot of policies, like the selling off of council flats.
Mm.
It probably wasn't. I mean, strangely, I don't think it was. People were so environmentally aware, but I think it was much more anger at the kind of attempts to restructure what society was.
Mm.
And I mean, this is not. It's just my supposition. It's not.
That doesn't matter.
Yeah, but. The idea of, you know, a car owning, home owning member of society, just, I don't know, it's like it really is a kind of thing that splits the country in half, I guess, because for some people it's like a dream, and then for others it's like, it's just not a nightmare, but it means that you're lost in private space, and you no longer engage with other people or with your surroundings. You know, you're someone who's travels in a bubble, And you know, you pass through places quickly without really kind of experiencing them. And as a homeowner, you're sort of living a lie because you're actually just indebted to the bank, and you spend all your time working really hard to pay a mortgage. So you know, it's, it depends on you know, how you look at these things. But that's, I think that was possibly why a lot of people felt kind of motivated to sort of try and stop the campaign. Having said that, I don't think most people were aware of what would be involved, how long it would go on for. And I mean, it's like, you know, you just sort of put your toe in and then you put your other toes in, and before you know it, you're kind of fully immersed.
Yeah. And were you personally involved in the public inquiries then?
What, the Stratford?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much every day, I think.
Right. What was that like?
It was a laugh. You just get dragged out by the police, or, you know, we do daft demonstrations outside. That was really good fun. No, I mean, there'd been a lot of preparation beforehand. We'd had loads of meetings about, there was toxicologists who'd done, you know, massive reports on the land that was supposedly going to be offered in replacement of green land that had been, that was going to be, the motorway scheme was taken away.
Yeah.
And guys from, you know, brainy guys from some brainy place had proved that the land was poisoned, you know, and it wasn't fit, it wasn't a fair swap and stuff like that. And you know, there's a lot of people who'd really put a lot of effort into making well, the public inquiry was it was seen as a kind of, it was interesting because it was the, for a lot of people who weren't, me included, who weren't really experienced in sort of real politics, I guess, it was supposedly where, there was a forum offered to present the case for why it was a bad idea to build this extension. And it was where, you know, the government would present its case for why, you know, so it was like, it was the focal point for all the organisation from, you know, from the first meeting councillor Evie Edworthy called, which kind of she probably regretted ever doing, because she was never that, really that supportive of the campaign. You know, I think she felt she had to, but she wasn't really.
Right.
I mean, the main guy that was Hugh, Morgan Thomas. Hugh Morgan Thomas? Does that ring any bells? Should do. He was a guy who's a lawyer, a barrister,
right,
who lived locally. Still know? Where the M11 Link Road campaign differed to Archway was that the catchment, the class catchment of Archway was much more kind of useful. There's many more useful people in terms of their skills. So there were like lawyers and maybe media people. And
right.
So there was just better contacts.
Yeah.
In Leighton, there was just a bunch of scruffy artists, basically, plus a few others. You know, there's like Christine was a nurse. You know, there's like, you know, it was pretty. It was, you know, good people, but not really necessarily useful skills. Hugh was one of the few people that came forward with really special skills, and he was I think he was a barrister. But he got really involved, and it was kind of hard for him because he was a very kind guy, very intelligent guy, and he realised that, you know, there was a lot of crazy people, you know, really were like a lot of very nutty people, especially from Archway campaign, who were just like nutters. And so he did his best to support us, but he eventually became a councillor on Waltham Forest, was it up there?
Yeah.
Waltham Forest and he became one of our main sort of kind of focal points within the council, and was she was critical in overturning council opinion in support of the campaign. Mm. She was like a really important guy, actually. You know, and so following the council's change of opinion, because they were for the scheme, even though they were a Labour council. Actually, Hugh was in court. I'm sure Hugh was in court when for non-payment of poll tax, for non-payment of poll tax, same time as I was in Waltham Forest, and. Following that, I think Harry Cohen changed his mind. Following that, the MEP, whose name I can't remember now, Labour MEP, changed his mind in support of the campaign. So he was actually a very kind of critical guy. I don't know, he, God knows where he is now. Maybe, I mean, he was good. He was like a useful, kind of sane, probably crack now, but he was no, a good man. The public inquiry was, I mean, I think it was inevitable that it wasn't going to go in our favour, but it was the kind of, it was the, it was probably as far as a lot of us saw the campaign going in a way, because that was, you know, that's what we'd been offered in terms of kind of legal, that was the only path that we'd been given,
yeah,
or we'd thought to take to fight the campaign.
Mm. You talked about delay tactics, which was part of the public inquiry. Can you remember any of those? You mentioned sort of a couple, but...
Well, I was just dressing up and shouting a lot, basically. And no, it really was just acting up. It was... I mean, you're best talking to George Saxon about that. He'll have a, I'm sure he'll have a more vivid memory. And because after that, it was so kind of deflating to have lost that inquiry, that a lot of people who put kind of quite a special eccentric skills into play basically sort of lost interest. So there was quite a long period afterwards where it was like a lot of scratching of heads, and then it became quite formalised, and there was kind of like weekly, often quite dreary meetings where you'd sort of work out, you know, sort of, for a long time it was just ways of working out how to kind of maintain media interest, because it was very media unfriendly. It was a very long, slow process.
Yep.
It was a very unglamorous area, and no one really cared about stopping motorways. You know, there was a whole raft of motorways being, new motorways proposed.
Mm.
Oxlis Wood, well, yeah, you know, you'll know.
Mm. And can you remember any of the other artists that were involved in those delay tactics, going to the public inquiries and so on?
I think the first proper demonstration was so kind of like lame. It was, I think Sheila Whittaker. I can't remember whose idea it was. I think it was Noel, who's an artist. Or was he a musician? His girlfriend, his name I can't remember, was a Japanese crazy artist who lived up Philibert Road, had this idea of dressing up in white boiler suits. Paper boiler suits with placards, and we did a little thing on the zebra crossing on the other side near the library, just sort of blocking off the zebra crossing. And we got in the local paper on the back of that, and I think Ian Bourne was doing it, and I was doing it, and I can't remember who else. It was just like who was there, and it was embarrassing, but we did it. And that was the first, I think that was the proper first one in relation to the M11.
Mm.
And then after that, I think Ian designed the main sort of logo.
Okay.
So he did the it was like a black rectangle with like a little truck coming through, like an exploding stuff. I can't remember. It's quite nice. And he painted up the huge banner. So Ian did all the artwork at a very early point. I mean, something that I thought was became obvious really later on when all the people from the Dongas tribe came was how little the visual artists used their particular visual skills in a propaganda.
Mm.
No, I don't mean that. I mean propagandizing. There is a word, but I don't know how you say it. To I don't. It's not that I thought that artists should suddenly make work about the M11, but people have visual skills.
Mm.
So we should have become like advertisers in a way, but to promote and highlight what we were fighting about. Well, we didn't really. You know, there was very little art done to kind of highlight the area. You know, it was only when the Dongas tribe came and they kind of decorated the various camps that they set up.
Mm.
And it was amazing, it looked great. I guess that we were polite because it was still our homes in a way, and we kind of, you know, it wasn't like, oh, it's going to get trashed anyway, so let's just sort of, you know, not fuck it up, but just sort of like, who gives the monkeys this to sort of, you know, splosh paint about. I mean, it's kind of a crude way of putting it, but, you know, even when it was me and Sal living in our house on 121 and Philippa Road and all the other houses being knocked down, so it was like this kind of last tooth sticking out of like some gummy jaw. I'm sure we still kept the gardens nice, you know, but, other things that were interesting. I mean, lots of interesting things arose. I think for everyone involved, it was hugely empowering. You know, you sort of learn to, there's a few things you learn. There's lots of things you learn. There's, democratic structures only work if you're doing what the government and state want. You follow the path of the state, basically, and it's virtually impossible to counter it. I mean, you really do need a lot of support. Even when you win something, it needs to have a maintenance plan, because if you don't, the state will wait and just come back and do what they want to do, which they're doing now.
Mm.
You know, there's however many years on, they're kind of opening up all the kind of road building schemes, like Oxlis Wood is going to happen now, probably. You realise what impoverished lives, how it's easy to lead an impoverished life. Well, how do I want to put it? It was quite frustrating that a lot of the time, it was so unglamorous. You'd just be knocking on doors, basically sort of discussing things with people, just to try and make the people of the area as conscious and aware of what was going on. Mm. Sometimes it would be because you want jumble, to make a jumble sale to raise funds to sort of, you know, put out some more publications. Mm. It was, you know, so it's like, you know, you'd use every opportunity to talk to people and just to maintain awareness. But, you know, the people across the road generally just didn't want to know. And it wasn't depressing, but it was like, you know, we're just across the road. But at the same time, you sort of realised that actually, why should they care? Because the artists that had lived on the other side probably considered themselves to be superior beings in some way, or above these normal people. And so they'd always, perhaps because of the kind of the short-term nature of Acme Housing, they considered themselves to be kind of, you know, slightly itinerant, that this would never be really their home. Even though it kind of, everything, it looked so suburban, it was like, you know, it was they could have moved at any moment really to the next Acme property if they'd been offered something with a bit of a bigger workspace, probably most people would. So they never really engaged with the people across the road. So why should they then be supported?
Yep.
But then, having said that, you'd make the case, well, look, you're going to have this great big motorway outside your... But they didn't care, because it was actually better. They thought that was better than having these kind of social divide. So that was quite interesting. Mm. Having said that, there's always exceptions. There was a lot of, you know, there were some local people. I mean, again, that raises other questions. I mean, in London, who is a local person?
Mm.
It's, you know, it's a fairly itinerant city.
Mm.
So, essentially, you find that most people rather not get involved in anything. And because they're kind of, they're fully... I think most people consider their lives to be fully, they're preoccupied already with kind of stuff going on. And I don't know.
It's interesting that what you talk about in terms of the community and what that's made up of, because one of the things I would wanted to sort of touch on was how you felt the artists, were they part of that community, or were they, do they consider themselves something outside of the community, or how did they engage? Did you feel that at that point that the artists there were, or did you think that they were part of that community, or do you think that the community, whatever that community means, I don't know.
I think that most of the artists that lived there didn't consider themselves part of a particular E11. They could have been anywhere. I don't think there was nothing. There was no engagement with the people who weren't on, you know, the people who weren't living in the blighted. No, I think most of the artists were more kind of concerned with, you know, getting their work shown and thinking about art magazines and adverts and reviews and stuff like that. Their minds were elsewhere. You know, they were astrally projecting to imagined fame and success.
And then this is sort of going forward slightly, but then also the relationship between the artists and the protesters, and by the protesters I mean the Donga tribe that came in. Was there any relationship there that went on, do you think, at all?
It's hard for me to say, actually, because it's not so straightforward, because some people were involved with the Donga's tribe, but I wasn't, because I suppose, it sounds daft, but geographically I was sort of in the wrong place. I was Philibrook Road, and even though there was a camp for a while at up Philibert Road, and then there was someone living up a tree, kind of, sort of for a bit outside of Leytonstone Tube. It really all was sort of, the main energy was focused down Claremont Road. And then, so there was a lot of people who were living on Claremont Road that, you know, eventually that took up, it kind of became the focal point for the sort of last part of the campaign against the M11. So, you know, Dolly that was living there, there was people that had been supported and had helped support the campaign that were like particularly focused around that point, but I think the people who'd done all the boring bit of keeping the campaign going in between the public, the failure of the public inquiry, and I think it was a couple of years on still after. I mean, it's quite a drawn out thing. But I know that Richard Layton, it was all a bit too crazy for Richard, and well, it's hard to say actually, because I can't really remember anyone's names properly. But I know that there were a lot of people who kind of did engage a lot.
Mm.
I think, and I'd. The first thing I'd say was, oh, but the people from Dongas tribe didn't really care about the people that were living in the area. Mm-hmm. They sort of arrived with their energy from Newbury. But I don't really know, because I didn't really get that engaged with them. So
right.
I don't know.
Mm.
But it seemed that way to me. But then it's probably because I sort of felt a bit kind of worn out, and I'd run out of energy personally. And, you know, it was like, oh, great, someone else has come. And, you know, the last thing I was thinking about was cementing my foot down a chimney pipe, you know, because it had been, been years of, like, often quite tedious stuff. I mean, there was a whole kind of doing Europe, where there'd be Colin Becks and a whole bunch of others who'd sort of bomb off to Europe to kind of annoy Carla de Ripa de Mianos. And, you know, there's all different wings. That and it was, there was so many different things going on. After the public inquiry, there was different, we were a very well organised bunch. So me and Sal were the Philibert Road sort of squatting to stop demolition contingent. Grove Green would have, it was Grove Green. Grove Green was so big. There was different people. There was Clodagh Rogers, I think it was. It was on Grove Green. There was different people on different roads, basically, that you'd ring up. There was a phone tree.
Mm.
And if anyone saw people with anything looked like a removal van outside their house, you'd get a call and say, so-and-so from number such and such, looks like they're moving out. So you'd immediately run round, and if they were, because the people who moved out, they had to hand their keys over to ACME, and ACME would ring, I can't remember the name of the demolition company now, but they'd come as well, ready to strip and destroy the place. We had demonstrations outside the demolition company that was now where McDonald's on Bow Flyover was.
Right.
I mean, we demonstrated everywhere. We demonstrated outside of Catherine Yass's dad's place, Irving Yass, because he was part of the Department of Road Building or whatever.
Right. I didn't know that.
Much to Catherine's embarrassment. Yeah. you know, so there was such a lot going on.
Yeah.
But basically, what happened is someone would be moving out, and you know, they wouldn't, or either they didn't want to, or they couldn't really sort of hand keys to us lot. So you'd kind of just about wait, and then we got very skilled at breaking in through back windows and stuff, and just all you got to do is just sort of break in, and then put a latch on or change the lock really quickly. And you know, it was quite good fun because it was like a race to see who could get into the house first. But this happened a lot, and this was our main way of preventing houses being destroyed.
Right.
And so it was very important to keep the houses standing for as long as possible, while there was still a chance that the road might be overturned to stop the air being trashed, you know.
And who would then move in? Obviously, you're saying that maybe yourself would dash in.
Well, there'd be a network of people. So, I mean, one day there was like a Venezuelan family turned up who'd heard that, you know, we were housing people. And, you know, it was just like, there was a net, it was known that there'd be properties available. So you just make sure that it was like a balanced thing. You could, obviously couldn't have a waiting list, but you know, it's quite, it worked quite nicely, you know. It was quite odd. I mean, I think I remember that family, because they really did arrive at the front door, literally as another call came, and we had to jump over lots of gardens to get into the back of one. It was down Philibert Road, you know. So that was going on a lot, you know, but in all the different streets. Mm. So it was like a lot of twitching, you know, keeping an eye on what was going on.
And did Acme know that people, that, you know, artists were involved in this?
Well, most artists weren't, because they were giving the keys back. I mean, there was only a few people. Proportionally, it wasn't actually many, you know, like a lot of... Most people weren't involved. It wasn't really a lot. It was just a few that, you know, managed to make a lot of noise and to be quite well organised.
Mm.
I think most people were kind of, like, supportive. But I also think a lot of people just thought, what's all the fuss about? You know, why are they making this? You know, what's so special about Leytonstone? But it's, you know, it's more of a case of, it was just, they'll build the motorway to there, and then they'll build it to there, and, you know, before you know it, it's going to be like LA. It's just going to be freeways everywhere, and just, it's all cars and nothing else. So, I mean, that's the proper attitude.
And you mentioned something about, well, you mentioned about the artists not actually doing maybe enough artwork or involving their skill. Because you also talked about the skills that are available.
Mm.
And but did you produce anything? Did you make anything which was...
Yeah, relevant? It was pretty lame.
Can you talk about it? Describe it? Whatever it was?
Well, yeah, it was just... it wasn't done, it was just sort of an anonymous thing that I made some blue plaques that looked like English heritage, and it just said our heritage instead, and it said this house was once a home, and I can't remember, I didn't make a lot because it was hard to make them, but I made a mold, and then just cut the fiber cast, painted them up blue with the white circle, white text, and just put them up on... houses that we hadn't sort of been able to save, just as a way of kind of a bit cheesy, really. That's what I did.
And how many did you make?
Not a lot, maybe just like five or six or seven, you know, not many. I tried to make sure there was at least one on every road. It was also quite difficult putting them up because you had to drill into bricks and stuff, and it was kind of hard up a ladder. And, you know, it wasn't like, yeah, it was just a, you know, a little idea. But you know, very polite in comparison to, a bit understated.
And can you remember if any other artists made work which engaged in some way in...
Not really. Not really. I mean, John Smith made a film about it, but that was kind of an autonomous artwork. No, not really.
No, that's fine.
I don't think there was any. It didn't happen.
And but then there was also the sort of the artwork that the Dongas tribe produced.
Mm.
Did you ever sort of visit their protest site?
And yeah, of course.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
What was your sense when you got down there, and what did you?
Well, aesthetically.
Yeah.
Well, aesthetically, it was a mess, but I thought it was fantastic at the same time. I mean, I thought it was really fantastic. In lots of ways, I was quite jealous because it was very straightforward. It was lots of positive energy. It looked like fun. It generally had quite a good feel about it. You know, it wasn't complicated by self-analysis, mediation. But it was also quite often quite ugly. But I mean, that's not a relevant observation, because that's a question of taste, which has nothing to do with anything. I thought it was great, and it worked. And it was an expression of the energy of the people that were living there, made apparent, and it was something that we never showed, because there was a huge amount of energy went into the campaign before, but we just never thought that it was all contained within, in a way. You know, so it was the only time it really came out was kind of the theatrics of the public inquiry, and the rest of the time, our energies were kind of channeled into the more kind of proper roots of, you know, like tackling councillors and MPs and other kind of politician type people.
Mm.
You know, so it was more about trying to work out how to get them to do what we wanted, but through their their language, their ways of communicating. So what was nice about the Dongas tribe was it was like, this is who we are, this is what we want, and you know, you've got to stop us being who we are. So there was a lot to learn from them.
And did you have much communication with them, or did things change by then for you?
No, I did. I'm not really, not at all. I can't remember why, actually. Like I said before, I think for the people who'd lived there for a long time, it was actually quite a depressing time, because we knew that a lot of the houses were pulled down, or it was just a matter of time. Richard Layton, probably about that time, had been evicted. He was like one of the few people who actually owned his property, and he'd been evicted and had all his stuff kind of carted off. And Richard had been so strong for a long time. And he's, you know, a lovely guy. It's quite hard, really, to they're like obvious defeats, and those things were quite hard to take. And I guess at that point, I mean, I know that probably I was probably just standing back a bit, because it was like, well, properly to protect yourself.
And when you went down there, did you ever visit the art house on Claremont Road?
The art was everywhere. It was, you know, on the street and... Why?
I was just wondering if you did visit the art house at all.
Yeah.
Okay, no, that's fine. I'm going to go back a little bit, if that's okay,
mm-hmm.
which is right back to the beginning of mm-hmm. Leytonstone, when you got there and you were sort of telling me about where you lived and so on. And I was just wondering if you and anyone else who lived there made any physical changes to the property when you were there for practical reasons or whatever it may be.
Not really. I think John, because me and Sal were there really by the grace of John and Doug and Tina, it wasn't really for us to start changing mm. things around. John had done a lot of work to turn his room into a studio, so it was all made as white as possible and all that kind of stuff. Doug, I can't really remember. I mean, I think Doug was teaching as a technician at NELP at the time, and I can't really remember if he was painting there or not. And I think Tina had a studio. Not really. Gardening, mainly. Lots of gardening.
And were there, when things sort of needed repair, I don't know, who normally did that?
I can't remember, really. I mean, I don't think... I don't know. I can't remember that. I mean, generally, I mean, we were doing everything ourselves.
Right.
But I don't particularly remember
mm-hmm.
the idea of repairing something.
Right.
No, I don't know. I can't.
So when you got the, well, you have friends already living there, so things like the gas and the electricity were on and running and that sort of thing when you got there, weren't they?
Mm.
Right. And what was your work like when you moved in? What sort of stuff were you producing when you moved into the area?
My art?
Yeah.
89. I think I was still making work that was... coming from a kind of an idea of abstraction, but it wasn't painting. I think I was very interested in using materials that looked like they were poor or impoverishment. It wasn't smelly things, but it was the kind of waste product type things. I think I did a lot of work with dirty old plastic and toilet roll inners and essentially I was thinking in terms of material and formal issues rather than anything having a more kind of a language outside of just sort of colour and shape and texture. But yeah, that's where I was.
And where did you find your material that you were talking about that you used?
Well, it wasn't like I needed lots of it. It wasn't hard to find. I don't know. I think I was working a lot at that time, doing scene building for theatres and stuff. So I used to take a lot of stuff from there. So a lot of fiberglass, resin. Mm. I don't know. It wasn't like it was hard to get stuff. It was rubbish.
Right. Okay. And do you think that your work changed over that period of time that you lived in the Acme houses?
Not really, no, because at that time I was really spending a lot of energy on the campaign. Also, almost exactly at the same time as the campaign, I was part involved in the City Racing Gallery with Matt Hale and Pete Owen, also from Leytonstone, plus two others, Keith Coventry and John Burgess. So we were kind of, as being an artist, co-runner of a gallery and a anti-motorway person. So it wasn't really the time to be thinking about my work, particularly because I think you need to have a kind of, you need to stop and think to sort of change direction or to reappraise what it is that you're not trying to say, but who you think you are and how you express yourself visually.
Yeah.
Afterwards, maybe it had a lot of impact, but not during.
And in what way do you think it had an impact afterwards?
In what way? I think that I didn't ever make any work that was directly about cars or bad governments or, you know, people watching their environment get destroyed around them and not doing anything about it. But I think I was quite angry. It took me a while to figure it out, but a lot of the work that I made, is it working?
It's fine.
Was I was sort of angry with artists and the idea of being an artist and the language of art. So I did a lot of drawings. I think I rejected the art language I've been using before, which was a very formal one, and it kind of for instance, a lump of foam just a piece which was stuck onto a bit of canvas and had a bit of mouldy old plastic hanging over it, which actually did look, they were quite nice things, but only if you had a very kind of trained aesthetic appreciation to understand the language of foam and mouldy plastic. And there's not a lot of people that have that, and it doesn't, you know, and maybe they're not, I don't know. Anyway, I decided to change the way that the language that I used, to try and use a language that was more generally understood as art. So I became sort of anti-avant-garde, and I decided to work in a way that was more, if it was art, it would be like tech drawing. So it wasn't really kind of art drawing. It was, or it wasn't even art. I was trying to find a commonplace where people who weren't necessarily interested in art could still engage and understand that they didn't have to suddenly think, oh, it's art and I don't understand it. I wanted them to feel comfortable with what they were looking at, which again is perhaps a patronising viewpoint, but it's just where I was at that time. So I did very kind of, I started doing very kind of illustrational drawing. And at that time, drawing really was, I think that it was probably about 92 or 3. And most people were kind of there was a lot of sort of quasi conceptualism about, and drawing really was like a left alone area, and there wasn't hardly anyone sort of using it, so it was kind of a very free area to do whatever you wanted. It didn't have any kind of, had very few associated values within the art world, but to most people it was a thing that, you know you'd see people down Piccadilly doing portrait drawings, or, you know, it's like it was almost like a non-art art form. I mean, now it's like it's taught at colleges, like, you know, drawing degrees and stuff, and it's rubbish. it's become another kind of another like known thing in a way. But the things I drew about were they were kind of against the artist, because I think I didn't really. It wasn't that you kind of know yourself first and then you make work about it. You make your art and then you realise you learn from it what you are and what you're thinking about. Not saying that you're like some sort of deranged idiot that just sort of, you know, does whatever. I mean, there's impetus. Anyway, so I did work that I think was against artists for being idiots. I had this idea that all artists were idiots on the back of, I'd say that was directly about the artists of Leytonstone to use their art skills in any kind of useful way. But then that raises questions about what's useful. It's what, you know, J.G. Ballard writes about this. There's, you know, in time, weeds will be able to crack the tarmac surface, you know, roads, buildings, they're just temporary structures and everything goes in the end. So it's, you know, and you realise actually that the few things that do survive aren't, you know, even the Roman roads get covered up. The few things that do survive are the artifacts of different periods, which are the culturally cherished objects that define what humankind understood of itself at the moment and how the future looks back to the past. And actually, the most useful things are objects that are made with, not all art, not everything that's made has value, but out of it there are a few things that are cherished and looked after. Usefulness is a very kind of vague term, in my understanding.
And then, but so you made a sort of very particular comment about artists at that point, and that was how you felt.
What, just now?
No, in your work, sorry.
No, not really. No, I didn't. I think it was actually while I was giving a talk about my work, like years after I'd stopped making those drawings, that I kind of thought, that's what I was doing. I realise now, you know. But at the time, I think I was just, I thought I was doing some kind of brainy work about the kind of gulf between textual and visual languages, you know, the empiricism of one and the vagueness of another. And, you know, I was completely tied up in some other aspect of the work, which was what allowed me to make it. But what was actually coming out was this quite transgressive, rude stuff. And, which I just thought was incidental to the main point of the work. But really, I think, the presumed logic was just, you know, my kind of textual visual thing was just kind of a necessary blinkering to allow me into this kind of new space where I could, you know, where I was just going to sort of get my general anger out about how crap artists are.
Yourself not included, maybe.
No, myself at the front, yeah. No, absolutely. No, I put myself first.
Right.
But yeah, it's really about myself. It wasn't, you know, when I say artist, I mean myself, really.
And do you think that...
Doug had a breakdown.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't able to see himself as part of a collective and share responsibility.
Right.
But I mean, also art is, it's not separated from yourself. It's how you often, it's where your extreme thoughts come out. You know? So that's how I probably diffused my disappointment. And also excitement. But I mean, the result was bad, but there was a lot of people who I think, as a consequence, became stronger people for it, you know. And so it was, yes. So, I mean, so your question about how it's an annoying and dumb question in a way. How does something like this affect your work? I mean, it's hard to know which part of it is the really kind of important part. You know, it could have been that, I don't know, it's like you might have saved a dog from dying on a, I don't know, it's like, I don't know, what's important? Is it important that you make some better art or not out of a situation? I don't know, yeah, it's like, it is a dumb question because everybody should be learning from everything all the time. It doesn't take, you know, like some essentially fairly tedious campaign, even though it is important, it was important, and it still has importance. It was not the most glamorous of campaigns, but you know, everyone should be learning all the time at everything that's going on around them. I mean, there's crap going on everywhere.
Okay. I was sort of also thinking about, which is sort of completely different to your work on one hand, but actually is exactly what you're saying, is part of it at the same time, that the social scene in the area, with all the artists that were there, and how an open door policy is maybe not a good term to use, but that sort of way that the artists engage with each other and how that sort of existed with each other. I don't know, I'm not phrasing it very well. How you sort of like, you know, how you moved around and who you knew and the events that happened and where you congregated and where discussions took place mainly. And I don't know, because you mentioned a couple of pubs, which...
There's two pubs,
you know,
yeah.
The Northcote and the Heathcote.
Yeah. There wasn't much... Well, firstly, there wasn't much discussion about art making.
Right.
It was more just getting drunk, I think. And it was, you know, it was like, maybe it's to do with the age of everyone, that everyone was quite young. A lot of people there, you know, it's quite interesting, actually. I think a lot of people there, they'd been to London art colleges, but they'd not been to what was known as the best art colleges. They'd been to North East London Poly for the majority, which is a bit of a kind of like, you know, it was like, I don't know what it's like now, but its reputation wasn't particularly good. You know, the best ones were Chelsea, I guess, and, oh, I don't know. So Pete had been to Chelsea, so I think he was like a little notch up in terms of the who'd been where. I'd not even been to London, I'd been to Hull College of Higher Education, wasn't even a poly at the time. Same as Sal. So I mean, it's quite a tight little scene, actually, and I was sort of, I did not that I wanted to be part of it, but I was quite sort of, they're all kind of quite a happy bunch, but it was all like, you know, it was, there was a big mass of them, and you sort of just go and watch, really. But I think a lot of it's to do with drinking, but it could have just been like that was the guys, you know, like there seemed to be a lot of, I think because most people that were there also, they were kind of generally, they were like abstract painter types. And I don't know what it must be something in the paint, but like they just like drinking loads of beer. And so it was just, yeah, just a lot of beer drinking. That's about it. You know, it wasn't like a really brainy scene or anything. It was like, it was quite odd. There was a few sort of, I suppose, sort of more famous artists. There was Cornelia Parker and Gary Stevens, lived up Philibert Road. But I think they must have gone somewhere else, more civilised. Never saw them out and about. Interestingly, Gustav Metzger lived in the flats further down. It's where me and Sal ended up living after Leytonstone, by the library up Leytonstone High Road.
Harrow Green,
yeah, around there. But I think Gustav Metzger was living there, but he was also obviously invisible because I only found out that like a long time afterwards. Yeah, I mean, you don't know really who's living there. It's I think it was just sort of it was more like there was pubs and there's a lot of people that went there who happened to be artists, but they could well have not have been artists because the amount of little discussion about art things was, you know, I think that's how I met Pete, and Pete was the person who asked me to be in the group show at City Racing when it wasn't really City Racing, and that's how I got to be one of the guys running it. So it was, you know, I suppose, but that was unsocial. It was like, it was more on, you probably thought, oh, I can get along with him and not argue with him, rather than, oh, I think his work's really good. And quite often that's how City Racing worked, really. Mm. It was because we wanted somewhere to show, and it was the same with a lot of people. So it was like, it was easy. Just, you know, give someone a chance to show. There was some discussion. Obviously, we didn't want to show someone who was like really, really crap, because you just think you're crap. But quite often it was like, let's give this person a go and see if they can, you know, do something special for us and for themselves, obviously.
Mm. And thinking about City Racing, I mean, so you're saying Pete started City or came up with that idea or as a group?
Oh, it's all a complicated thing. No, it was Keith Coventry's and John Burgess's place. They were living in Oval Mansions, which was a big squat. And basically, Oval Mansions was like 8 blocks, all with loads of flats. Each block had loads of flats. And 7 of the 8 blocks were fully ram full of people, as it would be, but Keith and John's was just them two, and they were like determined not to have anyone else move in, because Keith wanted it all for his studio, and John occasionally made work and just, I mean, basically they just sort of didn't want anyone else in. And I think that Keith's big plan was, I know, we'll open a gallery, and that way we can keep all the space to ourselves. So it was very, the motivations were very kind of like, you could say, like, not slightly negative, perhaps. And so the first show was just Pete and Keith, because they were friends from Chelsea. And then the next, but it was like, you know, it was for a week or something, or like a weekend. And it was just Keith clearing his studio out and putting things. It wasn't like, okay, it wasn't really like proper. And then the same thing happened again with the group show. It was me and the other four, plus a couple of others, and then we did it again. You know, it was like that, really. And then we thought, oh, we, you know, we go on and let's keep it, because it was we enjoyed it. But I think it kind of suited them. It suited Keith and John, because John had this kind of plan where he dreamed about 12 years down the line he would become owner of this, you know. And it came to the point where the council did try and evict us from Oval Mansions. Because I lived there in the end for about 5 years, and John was determined to sort of like, he thought this was his moment that he'd you know, he'd been planning for. And it's totally irrelevant, but
I know, it's interesting, keep going.
Well, but Pete and John used to have a massive Keith and John used to have a massive argument about a cupboard, who owned a cupboard. Or, you know, and this was in a squat, and we couldn't work it out. And it was because, basically, Keith had moved out ages ago, got a great studio, and he'd married and got a big house somewhere. But he was determined to keep some part of that because they both had this idea that they were going to own it at one point, and it all backfired horribly towards the end. And but it doesn't really matter. This is an interesting thing or not, but you can do things for one reason, but the thing, the consequence of your actions can be completely at odds. And you could do something, start something with a kind of fairly selfish, single-minded reason, but the consequences can be good. It's quite interesting about city racing.
And it had that whole thing about being in the squat, like you say, and sort of not reminiscing, but part of where you were living in those situations is just coming through. But I was going to ask you about city racing now.
It's all right.
That's not good at all. I remember. Could you think of many other artist-run spaces of that period in London?
The gallery was going for 10 years, so there wasn't any at the beginning, but there were lots towards the end, to the point where we were so sort of bored of doing it that it didn't, for a long time we went through different sort of energy levels, and at some points we kind of probably would quite have happily stopped, but there was still so little around that we probably felt obliged to keep doing it. It was nice that it felt that way, but it felt important, And then at the end it was like, Jesus, there's so many bloody galleries doing what we're doing, but probably better, with more idea, that it was quite a nice and easy thing to sort of go, oh, so you've had enough, finish, bye. Really early on, there was the showroom. It wasn't an artist-run space as such, but it was one that was a non-commercial space showing young new art. But it went through different guises. So I think David Thorpe was there for a while, and then it was Kim Sweet, and then I don't know if it was Kirsty Ogg straight after Kim Sweet, but was it? Anyway, Kim Sweet was there for quite a long time. It was always quite a strange gallery, and it still is, because it's so sort of irregular in a way. I know, it's like it's there, but not, but that's not a criticism, essentially. It's just kind of, it's a bit like in them sci-fi things when someone's teleporting in and they're kind of there and they're not there. It's like, are they there or not there? So showrooms like that a bit. It's a lovely space, and I've seen lots of really great shows there. So there was a showroom. Maybe a year or two after. Well, one of the first visitors to City Racing I remember was Adam Chodsko and Tamara Chodsko, and I can't remember who else it was. And they were kind of new in town, and they set up Milch, which was much more trying to be part of the warehouse, Damien Hirsty type thing. But that was, very good. It was a good space, and they did lots of really good shows. Nice. I remember a really good show by Padraig Timoney. A nice show early on by Douglas Gordon and Simon Patterson. There were lots of Hamad Butt, I think, did a good show there. But that was a good space. But again, it was sort of artist run, but it seemed to have a slightly different agenda, or it had an agenda. As opposed to City Racing, we were just all, what are we doing? Running a gallery? there was Nose Paint, which was Naomi Sidoriffen and David Crawforth, who then set up Beaconsfield with Angus Neal. They were running a kind of performance arch stroke nightclubby type thing in Vauxhall. And they were and Naomi and David lived in Oval Mansions as well. There's like bits and bobs, but it was very kind of like, you know, it was a big city with not a lot going on. I think Bank got going also about the time of Milch, but in a very different direction. And they made lots of really great shows, but again, a very different energy. They had great big chips on their shoulders, I think, and they were just kind of angry at everyone else that was famous, and why weren't they? But on the back of it, they made some really hilarious and genius exhibitions.
And it must have been quite tough to be making your own artwork and being involved in city racing.
Oh, really? No, it was easy. No, it was really easy. It's easy. It's easy running a gallery if there's no rent to pay. And because there was we had no money to offer. We were all pretty poor. We were all like either on the dole or just doing enough work to pay rent for studio or whatever. No, it was easy, really. I mean, people were so kind of like desperate to show. It was a piece of piss, but getting people to come along was difficult.
Right. So how did you manage that?
We stopped showing ourselves.
Had the desired effect.
Yeah. Stopped showing some decent artists, and it was like, you know, plain sailing after that.
Was Maureen Paley showing in her front room at that time?
Maureen had been working as a gallerist. The people who were running, Logsdale, Schubert, Carsten Schubert, Maureen Paley, Anthony Reynolds. It's about it, really.
Mm.
You know, in terms of serious, internationally minded commercial galleries, everything else was a kind of a bit like that guy who teaches at Chelsea, who's aged 50 and has been doing the same thing forever. Sort of kind of galleries, Nicola Jacobs, things like that. You know, like really kind of crap or kind of a bit interesting, but at the same time, you knew that they weren't Eileen Cooper. I mean, it's kind of nice work, but it's, you know, a lot of Ken Kiff type. That it was a lot of, I don't know, typical crazy eccentric British art, really, you know. But it's why Britain had been so insular. And it was at that point when Lisson was exporting all the kind of new sculptors like Woodrow and Cragg, and you know, they were getting there, that they were Julian O.P. It was an interesting moment.
And can you remember if any of the gallerists actually came to Leytonstone to see any of the sort of open studios that happened?
Almost definitely not. Yeah, I think definitely not. No way. Well, gallerists don't go to other galleries anyway. They don't go to proper galleries unless they're looking to do some horse trading abroad with one of their artists to swap for another one, you know.
But in terms of visiting Leytonstone during the open studios,
The Whitechapel Open was kind of, I guess the Whitechapel Open was the big kind of like thing to get into, because an important gallery that basically allowed, it was very difficult because you kind of knew that it was them allowing what they really thought of as unimportant artists to get to use the walls just for budgeting, you know, so they can keep their local finance. So that was the big deal. And then the Whitechapel basically tried to organize, I think what happened was that they tried to organize the open studios. So they took over, they kind of tried to get everyone to sort of fit their timetable.
Right.
And then they tried to get people, I mean, it's all well-meaning, but it was kind of wrong in a way, because anyway, so they organized coaches that in theory would sort of like, you know, fill full of interested collectory type people and take them around Leytonstone and other kind of distant studios with the idea that they could start, you know, they'd be interested in seeing, maybe buying even unrepresented artists' work that otherwise wouldn't be visible. And I don't know who, you know, it was crazy. It's, I can't remember, I don't know, it's like I think you just felt sorry for those people that were on the buses, if anyone actually did go on them.
So did you open your, did you apply for any of the Whitechapel openings?
I did, yeah, I applied for one, but they thought that my rubbish was packing, and I think they basically undid the work, so that didn't do very well. And then I thought they could get stuffed after that, so I did that. I did that once, yeah.
And you didn't get the work back by the sounds of it either.
I did, but it was all the wrong way around.
And did you take part in any of the open studios as well?
I did, when I was at Pixie Street,
right.
But that was before the Whitechapel was organising it. Because basically I didn't like the idea that, I thought it was quite good, important that the people in the studios organise their own open studios, and it wasn't about, it was just open, I didn't see it as a part of a ladder thing, that, you know, you open your studios and then someone from some more important place sees it and takes it there and there. It was a studio that was opened, and it's a much more straightforward exchange.
Mm.
And it's not a kind of, it's a last chance saloon for losers to maybe, just maybe, sort of escape from the hell of open studios to, you know, some kind of, you know, naff group show somewhere. It's like, you know, that's, so, yeah.
And did you do sort of informal open studios with your mates? You know what I mean? Just sort of opening it up and people come around? And...
Yeah, it was just, yeah, you basically have your friends come round and laugh at what you did, yeah. And you go and see other people in those studios. I mean, most studios are quite private places.
Yeah.
It's not that because you share a space in a building with someone that you might not have the faintest idea what they're doing.
Mm.
So, yeah. In fact, there's much about the kind of gelling with the people in the building than anything else.
Mm.
I think they're good things.
But not when they're organised by... In that formal way.
No, because it takes away, it stops that, what is important about open studios, it puts it very clearly in this kind of ladder of supposed progression.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
I'm sort of stepping back a bit, sorry, there's a question I should have asked earlier. What, in terms of thinking about things like the artist-run spaces and the project spaces, which partly could be open studios. What do you think and your police say there wasn't an art establishment, but what do you think sort of the art establishment as it existed at the time think of the artist-run spaces and react to them?
What?
I know what you said. Spaces, but how do you think they were sort of taken on board by more the established arts? Sort of like, you know, the commercial galleries or...
Well, they weren't. I mean, I'm not quite sure how those galleries that did show those commercial... I'm not sure where the... No, they weren't. They were not... They were rubbish. They were crap on the bottom of a boot that wouldn't go away. I think they just weren't... they were off the scale. It was like... I mean, most of the institutions didn't really show I mean, what did I see? I remember the Whitechapel, I remember seeing when I was quite young, like Clemente show and a Schnabel show. So they were showing. I mean, the agenda then of the institutions was very different to what it is now.
Mm.
I think it was quite important at the ICA in the early 90s, you had Emma Dexter and Ivona Blaswick and who else was there?
Matthew Higgs was there at some point.
No, Matthew Higgs was still. No, that was ages later.
Was it?
He was there. No, no, in 92.
Right.
It was there was three women curators.
Mm.
And they curated really interesting shows, where they were bringing over a lot of work from America, which had a really different energy to what was being thought of in the UK. So you get like Laurie Parsons, Scatter Art, Katie Noland, just very kind of quite crazy stuff. And I think the ICA had a very different standing then to what it does now, because its identity is a little bit confused at the moment, and it has been for quite some time, I think. But then it was a really kind of it was a really good space. And it's interesting that, you know, like, I think Ember's not with the Tate anymore, which is, anyway, that was one of the few places that was kind of, it had a kind of a new sort of energy about it. But even then, I don't think, yeah, no, I don't know. It's like it was different. It was like there was a lot of artists, but really it was a distant planet. You know, the access to a public space to show your work. I was just trying to remember, Emma was at Chisenhill before, I think. But then that was kind of an odd situation. But she was showing, you know, she was showing quite a broad selection of stuff. But I think she was kind of obliged to show people from upstairs in the studios, because it was very kind of linked with the studios.
Mm.
So it was kind of quite complex programming.
Mm. And do you remember a gallery called Art East, which was in Leicester.
Art East?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you were around when Art East was...
That was just before I moved there, but I mean, I knew all the people that were...
Right.
It was Gary and Doherty and Sheila.
Mm. Did you ever go to any of the exhibitions there?
Oh, maybe. It was Leytonstone. It was a pain in the ass to get to. I can't remember. I know where it was. It was in a nice building. I must have gone. I've erased it. It was probably so terrible. No, they were nice. They were quite good shows. It was like, you know, kind of crazy. Joe Rodriguez, Pete, Mark Sowden. I mean, it wasn't there for long. I think it was only a few shows, as I remember.
Mm.
But it was a nice, very good space that they got their hands on.
Mm. And you sort of mentioned that you moved. Did you leave Philibert Road and live elsewhere?
Yeah, my house got knocked down, and then I think we got a flat. Me and Sal got the council offered us a flat in Cathall Road Estate, and we were there for a while. Then we split up, and Sal stayed there, and I moved Wapping for a bit.
All right. And what was that? Were you evicted from Philibert then, or were you?
Well,
what were the sort of circumstances? And
I think we just—I can't actually remember. I can't remember at what point. We were still, I mean, we were still living there right at the end. I think there must have been a last sort of clear out. I mean, our house really was like, it was like a war zone. All the pictures where everything else was destroyed and our house was there. Next doors had been knocked down, both sides. I mean, it was pretty depressing.
Mm.
You've talked to Sal.
Mm.
Maybe she can remember. Does she remember?
Her memory is quite vague as well.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? But I think it just wasn't very nice.
Yeah.
But it also, it's probably not, probably doesn't seem like an important memory to have.
Mm. But it must have been, odd
to be. You'd have to hypnotise me.
It must have been odd to have been just this one house on a road, left standing. It must have been a strange feeling, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it obviously was. I can't remember it, though.
Okay.
That's a rubbish way of trying to draw the memory out. I mean, I've got a picture of me in the back garden doing pruning, but there's nothing behind the fence when there should have been. But, it's fun. Yeah, no, really, can't remember at all. I can't remember moving things out. We probably didn't have much stuff, to be honest. A bit like here, I mean, everything that I have is here. And at home, there's hardly anything.
Mm.
I mean, all my books are here, all my records are here.
You talked about the garden, and then there was that strip of land between yourself, or the back garden, and the railway track.
Yeah.
And was that used at all for the protests?
Which bit?
You're talking about the sort of fruit trees and so on.
No, it was used for people to get onto the train for free.
Right, okay.
Yeah, it's just a strip of land. It's just, I mean, that's the train track there. The gardens were here.
Mm.
And it really was just, with trees every, and there'd be a few trees here. It was just an odd strip. It wasn't, so it's not very good for you.
Doesn't matter.
So, but, yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's just, it was just a little strip of land out, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you, I mean, there are other things that are going on. You mentioned things like the poll tax.
Mm.
Did you get involved in any of those sort of political campaigns as well?
I went. No, I mean, since I was at school, I went to marches. I mean, I used to get in coaches and go to marches all over Glasgow and Liverpool. But I mean, that's not. Is that being involved in
in any way? I mean, I just wondered if you sort of saying you learnt certain things from the campaign, and I just wondered if you became involved in other campaigns that either picked up or became relevant or prominent.
No, I'd say that's the M11 is the only time that I became in any way like an organiser. In a political campaign.
Mm. How did you make your money?
My money?
Yeah, when you were there, how did you live? How did you survive?
Well, I think I was doing, like I said before, I was doing scene building for the theatre. So it was a lot of, a lot of painting metal black and making rocks out of fiberglass and all that kind of crap, stuff like that. But it would be often I'd work like really mad hours for like a couple of weeks and then have time off. Mm. So it was like blocks of work.
Mm.
So I think that's how I remember it during that period.
Mm. Did you sign on at all?
I didn't sign on. I don't think so. I signed on before. I definitely wasn't signing on. I think when I was at Wapping. I signed off when I was at Oval Mansions because it was not worth the bother because I didn't need the rent. Leytonstone, where was Leytonstone Job Centre? I signed on in Limehouse all that period. That was up to 89. Probably did. I mean, most of the money from Scene Builders, cash in hand. I can't remember. I probably did. I mean, I made work about being on the dole when I lived in Wapping. I was generally fairly honest, but not completely honest, I think. So I think I would declare, I mean, Sal was more honest than I was, to the point of being daft about it, but yeah, I mean, I can't really remember.
Mm.
Most of the time I was, but I know at the Oval I wasn't, so I probably was.
Mm. Mm. When did you leave Leytonstone? Do you remember?
Not really. 89, I think it was probably like 92, whenever all the houses got knocked down.
Yeah. Do you think there are do you think there are any benefits of living in that large artistic community, that you felt there were large benefits from it?
Probably not. I think that there's benefits of living in a community, but I think it's better if it's got people from all sorts of different backgrounds, because most of the time artists are kind of quite vain, self-seeking, and not really, they live in their heads too much, and you know, they need I mean, it's they've got a special energy generally, but you kind of, they need other sorts of people around them to make the best out of them. So if you get a whole lot of them together, it's like just not necessarily an ideal situation. Maybe sometimes, you know, you'll get people who whose ideas will influence others in a good way, and special thoughts and, you know, new ideas will come out, but not really. I mean, to be honest, I wouldn't say there's anything sort of beneficial about large group of communities of artists all living together, but there are, you know, I mean, I really enjoyed living in the prefabs before, which was kind of a lot of artists, but also a lot of other people.
Mm.
And afterwards, Oval Mansions, where there was, again, some artists, but just lots of different people from all different backgrounds. Mm. And it was brilliant.
Mm.
It was one of the happiest times of my life.
In terms of thinking about the protest and artists and art and so on, how do you think that climate has changed? Do you think?
Say that again.
Well, there's a protest. The climate. How do you feel the climate has changed? I suppose in terms of how artists approach galleries and how galleries respond to artists and where they're living and so on. Do you feel that there's been a change in that climate? What people expect and where they expect to see it, maybe.
And
the efforts they put in, perhaps.
Well. It's not for me to say, really. I mean, I have opinions, but they're not necessarily right. They'll just be based on my own prejudice, and I don't really do much research on this. It's not really something that you need to think about when you're making your work. You know, you make work, and that's all there is to it, and then afterwards, there's a whole kind of different. It's like a second life where there's people invest in your work in all sorts of different ways, sort of critically they place sort of different values on it. I noticed that when I teach, which is not very often, but in London art colleges, it seems that young people who are studying in London to be visual artists seem to be quite concerned about the sales of work. But, you know, you can't really, there's not much you can extrapolate from that. You can say that those people that come to London want, you know, they want to see sort of financial return for their visual ideas. But, you know, but you can't really sort of say, and therefore all, you know, young art practice is like that, because probably just in London that has always attracted fairly ambitious, impatient people. Everything that's seemed to be negative about, well, the positives of almost everything that of us human types do is kind of eroded by the marketplace. It's not just the art world, so it's, you know, it's just one part of a kind of, it's a cultural war, essentially, to replace one value system with another, where the only value system that's seen to be of any use is the monetary, as opposed to the intellectual or emotional. But that's, you know, across the board in everything.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.